Coming up on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm very glad that Dr. Art Sear has made his way through the fog, safe and sound here to WGTD Studios to pay us his monthly visit. As many of you know by now, Dr. Sear is the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage, a Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, author of After the Cold War. His columns and essays appear in newspapers across the country, indeed around the world, as a matter of fact. And we appreciate the fact that he makes time in his busy schedule to join us on a very regular basis to offer his measured and perceptive reflections on matters here and abroad. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Berg. I come for your introductions, among other things. You're always so gracious. It's a good tonic for me. Naturally, I'm sure our listeners don't have to be reminded that the fog you're referring to is the meteorological kind outside. Inside WGTD studios, there's always great clarity. Vision is 20/20, and everything is A-okay.
Well, we aim for clarity, if nothing else, and certainly fairness as well, if we can manage it.
A fog-free zone, right?
Right. So we have some important things to talk about, and of course, chief among them is the appearance that was just made by President Trump at the United Nations, and of course, there was tremendous anticipation of what President Trump might have to say, given the fact that he has had some things to say, both during the campaign and even in the days of his still brief presidency, about the United Nations and also kind of about the whole notion of globalism and global entities like the United Nations and if they're worth the money we're paying into them and if they're really all that effective or what should matter the most to Americans. So there was a lot of curiosity about what President Trump, in fact, was going to say when he took the stage at the United Nations. What he had to say was kind of remarkable in its breadth and variety, with some words of, in a sense, sort of felt like reassurance about the UN and its importance, and yet some very tough talk, of course, when it came to the matter of the regime in North Korea and others and the concern there about some of their more provocative moves as of late. What do you make of President Trump's remarks at the United Nations? Let's begin with there with that and then probe into some specifics.
Well, and I did assume you'd be asking about this. I'd like to try to say some things that are different from the chorus of criticism on public radio and television and in the dominant mainstream media, as conservatives like to call it. There is no sentiment in this country today, and the president reflects this reality, to withdraw from the UN. That's a tremendous change in American politics. For many, many years, including during the height of the Cold War, there was very strong sentiment for ignoring the UN as much as possible and trying to go it alone. Mm-hmm. When I was a child growing up in Southern California, not in Orange County, but it was a pretty populist, pretty conservative area, and conservative Republicans in Southern California came to overshadow those in the less populous Northern California region, the old-time liberal Republicans. During that time, I remember seeing billboards, including in the Hollywood Hills, get the U.S. out of the U.N. and the U.N. out of the U.S. Isolationists who were dominant in the Republican Party. Eisenhower was the minority candidate for the nomination when he arrived in Chicago in 1952 for the convention. Robert Taft, Mr. Republican, who accepted the UN but was extremely critical of it and our international involvement generally. Like Eisenhower, a very fine man, but with a very different point of view, he expected to be the nominee. All this ancient history, which I regularly talk about on your program, by way of foundation, over time, and the end of the Cold War has strengthened this, the UN has become generally accepted. And one of the things President Trump did not say is we should get out of the United Nations.
So, in other words, I think you're right that there sometimes tends to be a characterization of the things that President Trump says that are quite critical of the United Nations. They tend to be presented as something new, something outrageous. And
well, hey,
I think
what's outrageous, of course, is his style. And he's provided, in effect, not only something for the media to talk about, and I've talked before in your program about this unholy alliance between the U.S. media, desperate for not only profits but survival, as you well know, and Donald Trump, who is a genius at playing that instrument
right
to his own benefit. The president gave a great gift to Kim Jong-un and the desperate ruling clique, the very brutal and criminal clique in Pyongyang, Korea. Rest assured, my friend, that state media are going to be replaying his speech over and over again.
In North Korea.
And propaganda loudspeakers, yes, where it's pervasive and there's no real competition, though the internet is seeping in. It's a tremendous gift to that surviving, decadent, brutal, and very criminal regime.
Interesting.
That's the reality.
Yeah.
The political rhetoric is not the reality. This is the reality.
Right, right. What it means within those borders.
Yeah, and to us.
Right.
We further isolate ourselves in the world.
Yeah.
Which is not the way things should be, and the reason why presidents do not talk that way, there are very good reasons why diplomats seem to be so effete to some people. The president's talking to guys and some women sitting on bar stools across America who love to hear that kind of talk and talk that way.
Tough talk.
Themselves, absolutely, buddy. But that's not how the business of the world gets done,
right.
in real terms.
Right.
In real terms. And we've got to keep that in mind,
right,
as Americans.
Right. So I think what you were saying in terms of foundation is that there is a relatively long history of some antagonistic attitudes, not from everybody, but from, you know, certainly a substantial swath of Americans who have been suspicious of the United Nations right from the start. So at least some of what President Trump has said regarding the United Nations is not as new as we might think and not as new as it is sometimes branded. So that's one takeaway. But the other takeaway is that the way in which he chose to speak about the situation with North Korea, that is something you find unacceptable and very much a break from tradition, from what has ever been spoken by a president before. I think
of the United States. I did think about this some last night and even did some as a good student of Greg Berg, I even did some homework, burning the midnight oil, feeling like an undergraduate. When there is precedent for leaders, mostly from small and insignificant tin pot, often corrupt countries who like to sound off in the UN. Even they generally behave themselves, but one person who didn't was Nikita Khrushchev when he visited the UN in 1960 as temperatures in the Cold War were heating up considerably. He spent a couple of weeks in the United States. Fidel Castro, newly installed dictator in Cuba, came with him. Time magazine had a beautiful, very effective cover, I think, drawn by the great political cartoonist Herb Bloch. Khrushchev and entourage were gangsters. Fidel was some kind of mascot in fatigues, but they were a motorcycle gang, heavily armed, swaggering down the street. That's when Khrushchev allegedly, I think the evidence is pretty clear that he did, but I found it was a matter of some debate when a character at PolitiFact went after me for a statement I made about shoe pounding at the UN, but I'm satisfied that it did occur. After that, things became far more difficult in the Cold War. It was really a turning point from 1959 when Khrushchev also visited the U.S., went to Hollywood with great publicity, and became very upset that he couldn't go to Disneyland, caused a scene, as he often did, like some other leaders we've been talking about. But the spirit of Camp David, skillful diplomacy by Eisenhower and Khrushchev, seemed to be improving things considerably. Francis Gary Powers, a U.S. contract pilot, who went on to become a helicopter news pilot in Los Angeles, where he died in a helicopter crash years later. He was shot down in a U-2 plane over the Soviet Union. The Soviets made a huge show about this, as they were justified in doing. Other incidents in the Cold War meant things were heading south very quickly. And John Kennedy, in my opinion, a good deal less skillful than his predecessor, greatly exacerbated the situation. These events move in chain, in my mind. We had the Bay of Pigs disaster, for which Kennedy bears direct and publicly took direct responsibility. Serious deterioration in relations, leading directly to the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. That's not going to happen again, I don't believe. But the current leadership in this administration at the top is so unpredictable and I believe dangerous that we should well be prepared for some tough times ahead. But it's not the Cold War. It's not the Cold War, and the UN as an institution is far friendlier to us. I want to underscore that. Demonstrably, the UN as an institution is far friendlier to us than in the past. That makes Ambassador Nikki Haley's work, our very impressive ambassador to the United Nations, much easier. Antonio Gutierrez, not from the Third World, but from Portugal, a good NATO ally of the U.S., and another very skillful elected politician. Gutierrez, I think, has been handling things, including the current situation, very skillfully. The UN will continue to be important in a way that was not the case in the early 60s or for much of the Cold War.
And is part of what you're saying there that the UN, at least overall, is a more effective body now than it was? In what ways?
Well, the world generally is becoming more transparent and law-abiding, believe it or not. Paul Volcker, that durable, now very old fellow, Treasury official in the Kennedy and Johnson as well as Nixon administrations, head of the Fed, broke the back of inflation, nominated by Carter, the author and initiator of extremely important financial reforms during the Obama administration, during the Great Recession. There was an oil for food scandal during the long-term UN surveillance and significant restrictions of Iraq after the very successful Allied UN-led first Gulf War under George H.W. Bush. There was tremendous corruption. The Iraqis became extremely skillful at smuggling oil. They were, outside of humanitarian supplies, they were extremely restricted in their trade, especially their main export oil. They developed phenomenal underwater tankers, big submarines that had very little surface evidence that they were moving. carrying large quantities of oil overseas. They paid off UN diplomats and UN staffers to look the other way. Volcker, I mean, an utterly thankless task. The far right was after him. The Third World was after him. You know,
without a friend.
Powerful and rather dangerous profiteers out there were after him. He oversaw a phenomenal report that actually had an impact. Some UN officials were fired, UN procedures were changed, and internal policing and management became of an organization that is, by its nature, always going to have a lot of feather bedding and trouble. Think of the Chicago machine, old style, on a global scale.
Right.
The brother-in-law who can't find a job, the mistress, the guy who wants a lot of them from poor countries would wind up in the UN. I'm not exaggerating. Things are improving steadily in our world, believe it or not. And Volcker's report was a tremendous source of change right around the turn of the century.
Interesting.
Before 9/11, I think.
In terms of what President Trump said about North Korea, that gift he gave to North Korea, as you phrased it, that's an intriguing way to look at it, certainly.
Well, I tried to say something a little different on your program.
Right.
I want to thank you for the inspiration.
Yeah. Do you think it's safe to say, and of course it's difficult to say, I suppose, definitively, but is what President Trump said a reflection of what he himself personally believes versus what also, for instance, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson believes, or our Secretary of Defense, or our Joint Chiefs of Staff? I mean, the tone, as well as the specifics of what the president said yesterday, in your mind, should they be interpreted as his view of the world and his feelings versus the feelings of generally speaking, those within his administration? Some would suggest that he was speaking on behalf of himself as an individual. Whether a president of the United States is in a position to ever do that, really, is another question. But is that how you see it, or are you concerned that his attitude, his rhetoric, was a reflection of this administration overall, beyond the man himself?
I don't have any inside information, and I don't have any knowledge that everyone else listening to your program has, less than some, perhaps. I think it's very much him operating as his kind of personal lone ranger, which is the way he operates. I had a chance to observe his behavior from a safe distance, but relatively close at hand, when he was wheeling and dealing to open casinos and bring the Miss USA pageant to
Gary,
Indiana, when I was running the World Trade Center, which I did for 2 years in Chicago. A very satisfying experience. I learned a lot about how to handle challenging situations. We got the place out of financial trouble, the only reason I was hired, and didn't fire anyone. I mean, it was very good for my self-confidence, I must say. But I'm not here to talk about me. He was already wheeling and dealing and getting a lot of money from the state and making promises. I'm sure he didn't believe he was going to deliver on all this stuff, because he didn't. The hotel was never renovated. It's still a mess. The amphitheater is still ramshackle. Young ladies did come to Gary for a beauty pageant, but he spent a lot of his time escorting them on shopping trips to Chicago. All this happened after and was approved by the mayor before the phenomenal Mayor Scott King, who was good enough to work with us. And we did do some tangible things for Gary, by the way, as well as helping me meet the payroll, which I never missed. But Trump, early on, you could see it was the music man and the most large-scale and ominous. So I think a lot of what he says is baloney pitched to the, you know, he's throwing red meat to the base, very raw red meat. I also think he changes his mind. I don't think he has in-depth views of any particular kind. We have the situation where senior people in the administration, at the same time that the president early on was creating new problems and difficulties and threatening not to honor the NATO treaty, in particular Article 5, for collective self-defense, at almost literally the same time, the Vice President, Secretary of Defense Mattis were in Europe simply restating traditional U.S. foreign policy. You don't see others echoing the president. Regarding the tinderbox, the source of quite rightly, truly great concern. Please keep in mind the armistice is held since 1953.
Between the two Koreas.
Yes, and the UN and North Korea. And the UN and North Korea and China. The one war we directly fought China was the Korean War after their enormously effective in intervention militarily around Thanksgiving of 1950 when they devastated UN forces, devastated the U.S. Army, including the 1st Cav. The Marines held with phenomenal courage and ability, but the Marines had to retreat from the Chosun Reservoir. We want to avoid another conventional war and certainly a nuclear war. And the armistice has held since 1953. The fact to keep in mind, especially if you're watching cable news and or listening to commercial media, this endless scaremongering and speculation. Thanks to the courage of the Truman administration, and also let me emphasize the ruthless brutality of Dwight Eisenhower in creating the armistice. The armistice has held.
Did you just use the word cruel?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Can you just explain?
Ruthless brutality. Well, there were no military targets. Eisenhower came in 1953. He promised to go to Korea. People expected the great general to end the war. He did go to Korea, and in his memoirs, which are long and pretty boring, which is exactly what I contended, if you actually read them carefully, you can learn a lot. He looked at the North Korean and Chinese defensive positions. The people are exhausted on both sides. The American people want an end. I couldn't see any way for us to end this war through conventional combat on the ground. He did note the importance of the helicopter, which played such a crucial role in Vietnam and does today. The helicopter has tremendous potential, not just for removing the wounded, but as a tactical combat device and a strategic supply device, all of which was quite prescient, as he always was. But he decided to fold the war then and there and do it by any means necessary. We had good fortune. Joseph Stalin, Joseph Stalin, the totalitarian dictator of the Soviet Union, very conveniently died. It's clear now the war was initiated by him and Moscow, not Pyongyang on its own. We threatened to use nuclear weapons very skillfully and moved nuclear bombs very close to Korea and made sure people knew this. India, a neutral state and a very influential, very newly independent nation, but India was used by Secretary of State Dulles and the President, but especially Dulles, to talk very publicly about how we have no choice but to use nuclear weapons. Douglas MacArthur was fired by Truman, quite rightly, in part because he had introduced nuclear weapons to the equation, made it clear that the President was an inconvenience between MacArthur and God, who should be making decisions. So people were already alarmed and scared. Then something else happened, which classic Eisenhower can't be directly linked to him and was underreported then and now. There were very few military targets left in North Korea. Much of Pyongyang had been destroyed, but we'd made some effort to spare civilian populations. We obliterated the rest of Pyongyang. We had not bombed dikes and dams. We bombed dams in Korea, in North Korea, that in order to destroy their agricultural industry very quickly in May and June of 1953. You can trace these orders up to Mark Clark, the general in command, and a colleague of Eisenhower's, a very complicated relationship, but they'd worked together. Clark ran the Italy campaign in Europe while Eisenhower oversaw everything. Matthew Ridgway, a very great warrior and general, replaced MacArthur, and then Mark Clark had been put in command. Clark writes in his memoirs, Eisenhower made very clear to me that we were to use whatever means necessary to end the war. Now, whatever means necessary. Picture in your mind nothing but water as far as the eye could see. What had been farmland, nothing but water, with bodies not just of men, but in animals, but women, children, birds, you name it. Maybe an occasional tree sticking up above the water. That's it. Wow. And we kept on doing it. We didn't stop. I'm convinced, as usual with Eisenhower, the tough decisions, which he, this is the man who destroyed the Third Reich, Marshall and Roosevelt picked him for a reason. Off camera, when the microphones that were always on in Pyongyang were not around, American officers told their counterparts at Panmunjom, "We're going to kill everybody. Mm. We're making more bombs, heavy strategic conventional bombs, than we're using. We're making them faster. We can use B-29s for eternity. We're going to kill everyone. Mm. Don't you think you want to sign on the dotted line?" That's why the armistice is held since 53. They signed.
Right.
Even the North Koreans, you know, had had enough.
Right.
It's an extraordinarily tough warrior population on both sides of the 38th parallel. That's what it took to end that awful war, necessary war. This is what the current president's playing with.
Wow.
A man who has no direct experience, right. No direct experience with military service, whose rich parents went to extraordinary lengths to hire no less than 3 available medical specialists to testify that their son, a gifted athlete in college with, by all accounts, unbelievable social life. This guy had a lot of energy, and he was not physically apparently limited. You know, they got him a medical excuse to stay out of the military. This is the great belligerent, breastbeating, bully warrior that we currently have leading us.
Wow.
Sorry to get carried away, but we're playing with fire, including nuclear fire, and the approach that's currently being taken by the person in the White House is utterly destructive.
Right. So, in a sense, what you describe, and I knew nothing of that, of the circumstances under which that armistice was signed.
Yeah.
It's
well,
like,
for a reason. Eisenhower was the great magician, a genius at projecting a kind of image and keeping the ugly facts from especially us in America.
Right. And so in a sense, it was a different kind of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, it wasn't created in exactly the same way, but in a sense, it was a similar
yes.
sort of deed done for a very similar reason. That was to end the Second World War. This was to end the Korean War, to end it at all costs. And I would assume that this is a legacy that lives on in the collective minds of the North Koreans, at least
exactly.
to some extent.
1953 was yesterday, my friend, in terms of their collective view of the world. And there are reasons for the paranoia. I'm not defending the regime, naturally. There are reasons for their paranoia, which unfortunately seems to be getting worse.
Well, and their anger.
Time.
I mean,
yeah.
in a sense, there has been no rapprochement with them in the way that, for instance, with Japan, we have managed, since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we have actually managed to forge a strong and enduring partnership
oh,
with that country.
Oh, American leadership during and after the war, including right. General and then President Eisenhower, is very important to study. I'm very glad you brought up the two Koreas in that context, because I do believe as much as possible we should be deferring to the South Korean government, especially President Moon, a big improvement over President Park. She's ultimately a very sad story. She's now in jail and may go to prison long term. Moon was a human rights lawyer arrested by Park Chung-hee, president and dictator of the lady who was until recently president. But he's also a veteran of Korean Army Special Forces, and I can assure you, based on some direct exposure, about the most effective military in the world. They're tremendous soldiers and tremendous friends of the United States. So I really appreciate you bringing up South Korea. Regarding nuclear weapons, interestingly, Eisenhower and MacArthur and others were very sorry that Eisenhower always had very mixed feelings about using the bomb. Things have changed. He was a great diarist, and Eisenhower wrote for an hour every night, all the time, throughout most of his life, apparently, including every night when he was going 16, 18 hours a day.
Wow.
7 a week as Supreme Allied Commander. He became rather discouraged. The optimism has suddenly disappeared from the international community generally. He was pressed very hard in 1954 to use nuclear weapons when the French were going down. In their last big battle at Dien Bien Phu in Indochina. They were there before us. And George Bundy makes it clear in his very important memoir, The Nuclear Age, the records are now open. Ike said to his military commanders, "You boys must be crazy to use that weapon the second time against non-white people in less than 10 years. you're asking for disaster. I'm not going to go along with this. But Admiral Radford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the rest of the brass wanted to use nuclear weapons. The French were begging us in Indochina. That was a crucial turning point. We also went down to defeat. I heard some very senior people in academia talk as though they assumed that Lyndon Johnson, after during the Tet Offensive, when it looked like South Vietnam might fall, and when the city of Hue was overrun and held by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong for several bloody weeks, that they might well use nuclear weapons. But it was never seriously considered, which shows you what an important firebreak that is. They've only been used twice by us in the period of a few days in August 1945.
Right. And one hopes never again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and our leaders, Eisenhower, the more you learn about him, you realize that this allegedly do-nothing president was pivotal in all kinds of important moments during the height of the Cold War, not just in Korea.
Right. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business. We have been talking thus far about the speech given yesterday at the United Nations by President Donald Trump, a speech in which, among other things, he pledged that very, very harsh action indeed might indeed be taken against North Korea.
Inspired, of course, by Elton John, it's important to give credit where credit is due. He's Rocket Man was one of his. You're the music expert, right? It's Elton John.
Well, I'm not an Elton John expert, however. But
there's tremendous potential. I think of what you could do with David Bowie in terms of presidential speeches and presentations over time.
Right, right.
Maybe have a couple of current rock superstars. I don't know. It's a world I don't know, but it's so fascinating.
It is
the
fascinating.
Opportunities for the current leadership. Yeah, Rocket Man on the podium at the UN.
Well, let's talk about something that on the surface is no more positive, and yet within it is a positive story. One of your more recent columns, in fact, two of your most recent columns, both painted, in a sense, hopeful and positive stories that emerged out of catastrophes of one kind or another. I'm referring first to what you had to say about the anniversary of 9/11 and
what you
feel is the sort of central takeaway from that. The other is a column that you wrote about Hurricane Harvey. Evidently, that was published just ahead of Hurricane Irma. But, of course,
There was an Irma line in it, at least later.
Okay.
It's not easy being a deadline columnist.
Right, exactly.
But you're right, it was a Harvey column.
Right. But two tremendously destructive hurricanes, and now yet a third is bearing down through the Caribbean. So this has not been an easy time, needless to say. But some really important positive stories, of course, have emerged. And I want let's talk first about these tremendously destructive storms and the response and what you think is most important for us to see and understand and appreciate about the response to Hurricane Harvey and after that Hurricane Irma, for that matter.
Well, the not a new point, but natural tremendous storms and earthquakes and other acts of nature, what used to be referred to as acts of God in an earlier America and world, the ability of natural forces to really overcome what we do and can do is really quite striking and thought-provoking. But humanitarian relief capabilities are also vastly greater than in the past. And the U.S. has a very strong position and tradition, which people on the left especially should be aware of, so I emphasize it here. Starting early in this century and even before, especially given the reach of our naval assets, our Navy ships, we have been able to and have delivered tremendous humanitarian relief. I'm sure you remember J.D. Camus, the young military veteran deputy to Paul Herbert at the 1st Division Museum, an educational partner of ours in teacher education and student field trips in Cantinian, a great educational institution, totally renovated and reopened a couple of weeks ago. It's worth visiting. It's not a celebration of the military at all, quite the contrary. Great educational resource. He was a combat commander, a tank commander. I remember you were quite taken. And
had a great conversation.
About the nature of contemporary tank warfare, which he was involved in firsthand. He talked, I think on the air, certainly in the classes he visited, about one capital ship and a U.S. aircraft carrier can supply water without great effort, just going close to shore during the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake, for instance, supply water, easily supply food for a while for an entire city, and you can almost literally plug in the huge nuclear generators on the carrier to the city, town, power grid, and you can very, very quickly restore something like livable conditions to a city. And we do that regularly today. It's a tremendous strategic asset. As Lincoln said to an angry, very enraged Union lady who came up to him, he was always praising the people of the South. The president calmed her down apparently very quickly. That's a true story. Madam, do I not destroy an enemy if I make him a friend? And that applies worldwide, and a free society has tremendous capabilities in that direction. We can thank Theodore Roosevelt, if this is the column I think you're referring to. After the 1906 California earthquake, Teddy Roosevelt characteristically immediately sent the Navy and other military forces to provide order, but also relief. He got $1 million from Congress. I think he started, characteristically started the action before he got the money. That was a lot of money early in the 20th century, even by Washington standards. It's a big U.S. Mint in San Francisco, even bigger then, because we dealt in real money. And over 500 looters were shot and killed by the U.S. Army, including about 50 men who were in the process of looting the San Francisco Mint, which at that point had hundreds of thousands of dollars of real cash and actual gold bullion and readily tradable financial instruments. There was a lot of violence, but also immediately, especially the Navy again, provided humanitarian relief. The Navy removed from San Francisco, which was still burning and unstable, thousands of people. Statistically, it's still the largest evacuation by a single ship, I think in this case a battleship, in history. And from that time, we've come to expect presidents to go into action. A lot of us recall vividly the picture of President Bush, G.W., flying above the hurricane devastation in the South during his administration, and it became a pervasive news item, and he was much criticized. And shortly thereafter, he arrived on the ground in the bayous wearing his Western outfit and mingling with the regular people on the ground. Hurricane Betsy in 65 was the first to do $1 billion in damage, as usual, in the Gulf Coast. Lyndon Johnson was on the scene. President Johnson at 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m. was sloshing through the water with extremely nervous Secret Service agents and miserable water-soaked local politicians. LBJ was not literally pounding on the doors of shacks, shining a flashlight on his own face, shining it on the faces of his entourage, saying, "Your president is here, your United States government is here, we will help you." And as usual with President Johnson, within hours, vast amounts of federal relief resources were on the way. Teddy Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson set the standard, and now we expect the president to do this. The most pivotal was probably Herbert Hoover, who was Secretary of Commerce in 1927. He was a great organizer and engineer, like Jimmy Carter, a great engineer and a very decent man who did extraordinarily good work over many years. He set himself up as the most popular man in America and the inevitable Republican nominee and president in 1928, because this had never happened before. There's giant flooding that destroys your life, your family,
the Mississippi River,
your friends. Well, brothers and sisters, we all go to church, of course, or synagogue. Not many mosques at the time, but you know, this is God. This, at some level, this is what God does, and we can't pretend to understand. thanks to Herbert Hoover, that all changed. We now expect religious or non-religious, pagan, believer, Democrat, Republican, conservative, whatever. We expect the federal government to be there, and they are.
Right.
That's what I tried to communicate in this in this column. I'm glad you found it of interest.
Very much. I absolutely did. And, of course, I think most people would say that the government's response to both Harvey and Irma was ever so much more effective than it was, for instance, for Hurricane Katrina.
Well, FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Administration, I think, set up by Jimmy Carter, one of the many things for which poor Jimmy seems to get no credit. It was run by some socialite golf course buddy of GW, and the guy was incompetent, and the media, which disliked that Bush, I think it's fair to say, much as the vast mass of the media hates the guts of our current president, they really seized on that. And after that, FEMA became a pristine public service institution.
They've done good work. And, of course,
beware of socialite buddies who get appointed to any office.
Sure. The other thing that, of course, was a takeaway from Harvey and Irma, too, was a sense that it is in these moments where we experience catastrophe, or some of us do, that we have this capacity to come together in a way that would have seemed impossible a few weeks ago, and not that it's suddenly we have a rosy unity that won't dissipate, in fact probably pretty quickly, but nevertheless,
rosy unity, that doesn't sound like a long-term phenomenon,
right? But
roses are very fragile,
right? But it does seem to in some ways can bring out the best of us in terms of our generosity and courage. And certainly that was also what you wanted to say about the tragedy that unfolded on 9/11 back in 2001. And I think you're concerned that one of the most important takeaways from that whole experience does not get talked about enough, although you've talked about it before on this program. But I think this is a good moment for us to revisit that. So explain what you see as one of the most important stories of 9/11 that to this very day is not always sufficiently remembered.
Most of the time I commute from the south to work up the interstate or up 41 or Green Bay Road when I'm feeling good and have some time. I remember after 9/11, there's a gas station and convenience store that's been on just to the east of 75th Street, I think it is, as you're going east, off you get off the interstate, on the south side. I believe they're probably a Sikh family, not a Muslims per se, but I happened to stop there after 9/11. And I noticed a lot of people. There were more customers than usual who were going out of their way to be very friendly to the two gentlemen in turbans behind the counter. And I'm sure other people saw that. So I made a point of stopping at this place. I saw one biker type who, we all have our stereotypes and our prejudices. I don't associate bikers outside of veterans issues. I wouldn't associate this particular gentleman just on appearance, but he was going out of his way, obviously, to talk to I think in this case, a lady was behind the counter. And we all saw a lot of that after 9/11, efforts to reach out. And you can compare that to our treatment for a time only on the West Coast of Japanese Americans who were interned. Even then, that was not our best or dominant instincts. As I think I mentioned in the column, Franklin Roosevelt was not happy about this internment of the Japanese. And there was some limited persecution of Germans and American, German and Italian Americans elsewhere in the country, and Germans per se, but it was not by the government. Roosevelt emphasized unity throughout, as probably all of us know, very, very wisely. And I mean, African Americans played a crucial role, especially in the Battle of the Bulge. They made it a decisive difference. Truck drivers who were invited to go into combat and, of course, lose their rank and go back to private as usual, given the time at the bottom, given the times, our usual behavior. During the Jim Crow era, Native Americans were vital code talkers, pretty good Hollywood film, because Navajos, especially, if you're not a Navajo, you just can't penetrate that language. Roosevelt, for all kinds of good reasons. Earl Warren, the ambitious Attorney General of California, who became governor and a Republican vice presidential nominee in 48, he pushed the whole thing, the liberal Supreme Court justice. FDR did not like Republicans outflanking him. J. Edgar Hoover told the president it's completely illegal. Hoover, I underscore to our listeners. Warren went ahead with it, but it was only limited to the West Coast, and it was always controversial, and it faded.
This internment process.
Yeah, and I'm satisfied with that. I had the privilege of talking to a longtime senior editor of the Japan Times. We'd built a big program on Asia when I worked at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. He had been a student at Carleton College in Minnesota, an exchange student, when Pearl Harbor was attacked. So the poor kid was literally isolated in America. People in Northfield and the Twin Cities went out of their way to be helpful to such young people who were stranded. He graduated from Carleton with honors, took the train to the University of Chicago, went to graduate school, worked in the Quadrangle Club. A young Japanese from Japan, who clearly was not a Japanese American even, he said he had no problems at all throughout World War II. Wow. As long as you weren't in California or Nevada, right there where Earl Warren was in charge, even for the Japanese Americans, it wasn't that bad. But I think all that's faded.
Right.
Any incident gets tremendous publicity, including current incidents of anti-Islamic, any kind of incident. But we really do. I really strongly believe, in my lifetime, I've seen it. I post-date World War II, but we've all seen it. We are much more tolerant collectively.
Yeah, I think you're trying to say that while the regrettable incidents should not be ignored, but by the same token, we should not interpret them in a way that isn't helpful and that paints an inaccurate picture of us as a whole.
Yeah, and any religion, real religion, not bad religion, any religion of consequence, I believe that's the basic message. Including of Islam. That is the basic message if you actually stop to look at it, and it's why religion is such a continuing powerful force, even in these secular times. Osama bin Laden, far more consequential leader, far more dangerous than the nutcase in North Korea we've been discussing. I'm convinced that he always planned things very, very carefully. His nickname was the accountant. You had to have a business plan if you wanted some money to carry out any strikes. 9/11 was planned in detail. He hoped sincerely, and I'm sure prayed constantly, that we would immediately lash out, especially with air power, against whatever target we could find. And the Iraq invasion, to my mind, reflected some of that sentiment. The U.S. showed great restraint. If we hadn't, I think the Saudi regime could have been toppled. Major oil supplies for the entire world, actual and in the ground. Pakistan could have been toppled, both governments fragile, with powerful fundamentalist and fanatical constituencies in their borders. Pakistan, of course, has nuclear weapons. I think that was bin Laden's hope, and it was not a crazy hope. And thank God, at least for a while, the Bush administration and the American people resisted any impulses like that.
Well, on that... at least somewhat positive note. I mean,
oh, I think it's positive. Sure.
Very much. I mean, it emerges out of terrible tragedy, but of course.
Greg, you're always positive. We all know that.
All right, let's say then on that positive note, Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, distinguished professor at Carthage College, I do deeply appreciate you being here. Thank you for yet another engrossing and really fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure. I'm glad we make good music. Good medicine, Greg.
Right.
Powerful.
So we'll see you in October.
I hope so.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview I'm very excited to share with you. It's with three representatives of the Kenosha Writers Guild. This is a group of amateur writers of various stripes who gather on a very regular basis. As a matter of fact, on the campus of Carthage College in a beautiful Straz Hall to share one another's work with each other and to receive honest and heartfelt response and critique. They have published a collection of some of their works into a piece called Undertow, and they have a big launch event coming up for the release of this new publication next week. And tomorrow on the morning show, you're going to be meeting three of these amateur writers and finding out what it is about writing that they love so very